For Arizona Public Media, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Coming up, since 2010, Border Patrol agents have killed 17 people on the U.S.-Mexico border. We'll hear a report on how these cases are being investigated. The national nonprofit Big Brothers Big Sisters is celebrating 50 years of matching up youth in need with positive role models. But as we'll hear, volunteer Big Brothers are getting hard to find. Learn about the world of trans poetics and the recent first ever symposium held on transgender poetry. And hear a conversation with author Edmund White, who's been chronicling the gay experience for more than four decades. Those stories are all next, here on Arizona Spotlight. This week, the United States Senate has been discussing an immigration reform proposal that seeks to strengthen border security. Congress is also calling for a reevaluation of the Border Patrol's use of deadly force. Investigations into these cases are hidden from public view, and sometimes they can drag on for years. Next, Michelle Morisco reports.
Daida Elena lives in a small mobile home park in Nogales, Arizona. The wooden fence that surrounds her property sways in the breeze of a windy morning. Some of her youngest grandchildren play in her neat living room. She shushes them and sends them off to one of the bedrooms. And then she talks about her dead grandson, Jose Antonio. Nine months ago, the teenage boy was shot and killed by U.S. Border Patrol agents. The agents said they were defending themselves against a hail of rocks being thrown at them from the Mexican side of the border. Police reports describe a hectic few minutes where federal agents came under attack and then an agent and possibly two fired into Mexico. Jose Antonio was hit six times. Elena and her family say the boy was innocent. A witness reports he wasn't even with the group attacking the agents.
It becomes real chaotic, and it happens very quickly is what people don't realize is they get into a high response situation. Everything happens very quickly. I mean, the whole thing could be over in less than 3 minutes from start to ending, and it seems like it's taking hours.
Terry Kirkpatrick retired as an Immigration and Customs Enforcement official in 2010. He's been following the case closely ever since it happened.
I would be questioning if it was one of my agents as to why that happened.
In the past year, the Border Patrol has come under criticism for its use of force policy. Since 2010, agents have killed 17 people along the Mexican border. The policy states agents can shoot to defend themselves if they feel their life is at risk. And in each case, agents said they were being attacked, some with rocks or cars, or some with physical assault. But it's not always clear if the person shot was actually involved in assaulting the agent. That's especially true in the seven cases involving an agent firing into Mexico. Under the Senate's immigration reform bill, proposed changes to the policy are small. Within 6 months, Homeland Security and the Department of Justice must establish a policy for accepting and investigating complaints. That happens already, but at a snail's pace. The overall policy will also be reviewed. But the secretive aspects of the investigations remain unchanged. In the October case, neither the public nor the family of the dead teenager know the names of the agents involved. Michael Nicely was chief of the Border Patrol in Tucson for 3 years. He says the lack of transparency in Border Patrol shooting cases is what leads to the criticism.
The public understands that Border Patrol agents have to use deadly force from time to time, but they do not understand why the government doesn't tell them these were the circumstances. Our agent did exactly what he was supposed to do, and unfortunately someone was killed.
For Taide Elena, it's been 9 months since the killing. To this day, the FBI has the case, but has not contacted the family or told them anything about the investigation.
Nada, completamente nada.
She says the lack of learning anything about the case hurts the most right now. Reporting from Nogales, Arizona, I'm Michel Marisco.
This year, the national nonprofit Big Brothers Big Sisters is marking 50 years of community involvement. The organization's mission is to put boys and girls who are in need of positive role models together with adult volunteers. But these days, the organization is having a hard time finding enough Big Brothers. I talked with two pairs of Bigs and Littles, as they call themselves, along with a Big Little matchmaker to find out how it all comes together.
Tell me your name and your age.
Mariana, and 11.
And what were you looking for when you thought about getting a big sister?
That it'd be a lot of fun.
Why did you think that, though?
Just because I like having to hang out with someone older than me, because a lot of people my age I can only find at my school. And I hang out with a lot of people who are younger than me. So it's good to have someone who's older than me to hang out with.
Tell me your name and your age.
I'm Stone, and I'm 13.
And what did you hope that you might find when you first thought about getting a big brother?
Someone who would be sort of like me, but older and fun to hang out with.
And how well do you think they did in finding a match for you?
Very well.
Do you like being called Littles?
I don't mind it because I have been the shortest person in my class since kindergarten, so I'm always called a little or short one, so it doesn't really matter to me.
What about you, Stone? How do you feel about it?
I don't really care.
I also met Mariana and Stone's Bigs. I started by asking Hannah, a 19-year-old student at the University of Arizona, why she decided to become a big sister.
I actually had a friend who was involved in a Big Brothers, Big Sisters type organization, and so she had a little sis when we were in high school. And I remember hanging out with them and thinking that it was so cool, you know, such a cool opportunity to be able to spend time with a younger person who wants to spend time with you. And I have a little brother, but we're pretty close in age, and I've always wanted a little sister. So that was the big motivation, I think, for checking out Big Brothers, Big Sisters. But then after getting to know more about the program and everything and just the sort of values, I just sort of fell in love with it and thought it was so cool, and then just got matched perfectly. You know, couldn't be happier with another little sister, so.
You look like your sisters. Do people tell you that?
Yeah, uh-huh.
Describe the mission statement and what you found important in that.
I think the part about it that really stuck with me was being there for kids that, you know, need like some stability in their lives, or, you know, even just somebody to go hang out with when, you know, if they're worrying about things, if there's stress in their lives. And, you know, sometimes we forget how stressful childhood can be.
What were some of the first activities that you thought of to share?
I know we went to golf and stuff. I think that was our first outing.
Golf and stuff was the first one. I remember because I really wanted to go.
And now how do you plan what you're going to do together when you're going to have a date?
We just text each other or call.
It's pretty modern.
Stone's big brother is Randy, and for him, involvement in the program has become a commitment.
I've been matched with Stone for 6 months, but he's actually my fourth little brother. I've done it more or less for about 20 years.
What keeps you volunteering?
Well, it's a lot of fun. First and foremost, it feels like it keeps me young as well. I get to do activities I wouldn't otherwise do on my own. And it's just a chance to give back to the community, but I wanted it to be something meaningful to another individual as well. So I didn't want to serve soup for 100 people at the soup kitchen. I wanted to try to work with one young man directly, and it's been a lot of fun.
In your estimation, who was the most nervous the first time you met, you or Stone?
I think I was. He was working with the model trains in their basement and just generally having fun and hanging out. I was the one that was nervous that he would like me.
Well, in your case, you know, having had more than one match in the past, did you have a strategy for how to establish a rapport with Stone?
No. I like to let the Littles take the lead on what the first couple of activities are. Then we try to flush out their interest. I mean, he's at an age where everything is new that he hasn't done before. And I'm at an age where I have to rediscover things that I forgot I liked.
Stone, did you think that Randy might have been nervous at all when he first met you?
Definitely.
How did you feel, though?
Nervous.
My name is Allison. I'm a program specialist at Big Brothers Big Sisters. Mainly, I interview littles and interview bigs, and I match them together. I also coach their friendships throughout their match, so I talk to them every month on the phone and ask them how things are going.
What are some of the most important things when you're doing the interview?
Mainly, we look at personality and interests, and then your location in Tucson. So we don't want you driving really far to meet with your little. But the best matches we have are really based on personality, so they have that to share.
Do you have a lot of returning bigs to the system and maybe even littles who come back as bigs later?
Yeah, just like Randy, he was in a match and he really enjoyed it. We do rematch a lot of little brothers and a lot of little sisters because matches close inevitably, whether people move or they no longer have the time. But definitely see a lot of repeat visits.
Depending on your volunteers coming from the community, do you have an equal amount of men and women who want to join the program and become bigs?
No, not at all. We have a lot of big sisters, but we're always in need of big brothers.
I think it's about taking a little bit of time now to make an investment in that child's future. And I think the proudest moment would be to know that a little turned around 20 years later and became a big themselves.
I think similar to what Randy has already said, it's one thing if you are, wanting to sort of serve in the community a little bit. From my perspective anyway, it's just so much more meaningful to be able to have that individual connection, the sort of, heart-to-heart connection that you're not going to get unless you are consistently interacting with someone else and being open with someone else. And I think that's just so vital in kids' lives, and it's always vital in the lives of adults. You need to interact with children, I think, to be happy and healthy. So yeah, that's what I would say.
A first-of-its-kind event happened in Tucson in May. Casa Libre, a literary nonprofit, hosted a national symposium on transgender and genderqueer poetry. Laura Markowitz spoke with organizer T.C. Tolbert and keynote speaker Joy Layden about the emerging language of trans poetics.
Why and why and why should we call a transition a miracle?
T.C. Tolbert is a local poet and co-editor of an anthology. It's called Troubling the Line, Trans and Genderqueer Poetry and Poetics. It's the first collection of its kind. It inspired Tolbert to organize a symposium to talk about the intersections of gender, transgender, and poetry.
This conference is a love letter to my younger genderqueer self who felt incredibly alone and felt like there's no way there's anyone else like me.
There's a common theme among transgender and genderqueer writers, and that is the pain and despair that they experienced growing up fundamentally different from everyone around them.
We're either comedic relief, because we're so funny and weird, or we're victims. And that's true, too. I mean, the levels of violence against trans people, it's exorbitant. A trans person is murdered every other day worldwide. For being trans, I was desperate to see trans and genderqueer people living full, complex, happy lives.
Tolbert teaches creative writing at the University of Arizona, where Tolbert earned a master's degree. It's awkward to pick a pronoun here, because Tolbert isn't exactly a she, and isn't exactly a he.
I'm transgender in that I have a female body, and I've transitioned to live as a masculine person. A lot of people would, refer to me as a guy.
It should be noted you have a beard.
Yes, I do, which I'm very excited about.
If you believe that biology assigns us at birth either to the pink team or the blue team, how do you make sense of transgender?
Experience of gendered identity does not match, and I put that in air quotes, what our society or culture expects based on birth sex. A lot of times when folks think of someone who's transgender, they think of someone who is also transsexual. So someone who has taken steps to change their body. So someone who's on hormones or who's had surgery to transition. And genderqueer is a bit more fluid. It's more of a liminal or middle space. It could also be a more political identity. I use it to foreground the fact that I don't feel like a man trapped in a woman's body. I feel very connected to my female self and very connected to my masculine presentation.
Sometimes T.C. Tolbert uses the pronoun he, she to describe him, herself. Our language falls short when it comes to having the right words for transgender people. That's where poetry can help.
I could do things in language and create a world for myself that I didn't know how to inhabit with my body.
The physical body is not as malleable as the textual body. Mm. You could make any body you wanted on the page.
That's exactly right. I cannot separate my body, my identity from my poetics. I do identify as a trans and genderqueer and feminist writer, all of those things. My ideal poem is a simultaneous poem. I want to take all three of those descriptors and lay them on top of one another because that's who I am, all at the same time. If I can figure out how to do that in a poem, I can be done.
I always liked how Rilke, who admired the sculptor Rodin so much, used to say, how can we write a poem that can stand up and be three-dimensional, that we can walk around it?
Exactly, yes.
I think if any poet came close, it was him, who was raised as a girl until the age of 6 or 7.
Exactly, and says to love the questions themselves. For me, as a trans and genderqueer writer, that is a way of life. It's a way of writing.
Like T.C. Tolbert, Joy Ladin is a transgender poet. She also took refuge in language from a very early age.
I grew up writing poetry, and that was the only time that I felt that I was really alive, because it was the only thing I could do that was not part of this horrible nightmare of sex and gender that I was stuck in. As someone who had a male outside, which grouped me with the boys, but a female gender identity that made me feel I rhymed with girls.
Suddenly, you exist for a purpose. Your unbelievable confidence that you can escape the skin that felt so ugly and still become yourself changes the people.
Ladin holds the David and Ruth Gottesman Chair in English at Yeshiva University's Stern College for Women. She's written a memoir called Through the Door of Life, and she's also published 6 volumes of poetry. She was the keynote speaker at the Trans Poetry Symposium.
One of the things that's cool about not being able to finish the sentence I'm, even though I'm in my 50s, is that it means that my identity is an uncompletable process, which is one of the great human truths. So the thing about being trans that I'm starting to think is one of the ways in which we tend to be different than non-trans people has nothing to do with gender. It has to do with the ratio of the aspects of ourselves that feel stable, that feel like being, that feel like what we know about ourselves, and the aspects that feel like becoming. So for us, the becoming part tends to be way bigger than the being part, or way bigger than other people's being part.
That shifting state of becoming was excruciating for Ladin. She tried to kill herself several times. And when she finally decided to transition, it shattered her family.
One trans guy in Canada said, when you transition, people will tell you you have a lot of courage. When people say that to me, I always say it doesn't take much courage to run out of a burning house. Some people transition before the house is burning down, but I didn't, you know, for the sake of my family was determined to die as somebody I knew that I wasn't. And then I started falling apart, so my house was burning down. But I've come to realize that it actually does take courage to run out of a burning house.
T.C. Tolbert calls Joy Ladin the godmother of trans poetics. So what exactly is trans poetics? Is it just a transgender person writing a poem?
I'm a poet and I sometimes write explicitly about trans experience. But when you say poetics, you're talking about the building blocks of making poetic experience. And that, I think, is different.
What do you mean by that?
What makes something poetry is not denotation. So when you write about autumn, in autumn, the leaves
on the trees turn and it gets windy and cold, the odds of that being experienced as poetry are pretty small. And they're small not because you're doing something wrong with language, denotation and description are important parts of language, but it's small because poetry works by layering, overlapping, and creating collisions between different kinds of semantic and linguistic systems. The use of language triggers neurons to fire all over the brain. So poetry is kind of like creating fireworks inside the reader's brain. And some of those fireworks point us toward specific areas of experience. When it comes to what I would say, what I call transpoetics, to some extent it needs to be grounded in the human experience of being and becoming. So the experiences of being in between, the experiences of sliding back and forth, the experiences essentially of being a kind of thing for which your culture and world doesn't have adequate terms, but which still is.
You don't need to resolve these problems as poets. You need to just find ways to enact them. Make your problems your reader's problems. Give your reader the trans experience. Don't wrap it up into a referential bow. Or do. What kind of syntax do you need? Maybe you do need new nouns. Maybe you need new verbs. Maybe you need new verb tenses. English has a lot of underused and unused verb tenses. There's all kinds of stuff you can do with the English language that most poets don't do most of the time.
Layden says language has been changing.
The word transgender probably is about 15 years old. And until you had that umbrella term, you couldn't have an anthology of transgender and genderqueer poetry and poetics like Troubling the Line, which is the first of its kind. And without that, you wouldn't have had this kind of symposium. So what we're seeing is an extremely accelerated process of historical development.
T.C. Tolbert and Joy Layden hope transpoetics will continue to build a new vocabulary to describe and celebrate those who exist between the binary of male and female.
May there be women who call themselves men. May they see us. May we know them, and may we know them, and may they not kill us. May we not thank them. May they be us. May they not thank us. May we not kill them. May they not kill them. May they call themselves women.
I'm Laura Markowitz for Arizona Spotlight.
And may they not kill us. May we not call them killers.
You can hear both Joy Layden and T.C. Tolbert read some of their poetry on the Arizona Spotlight page at azpm.org. Edmund White is a New York-based novelist and essayist whose professional career began in the early 1970s. He's been writing about social issues and same-sex love for over four decades, and I ask him to share with us an excerpt from his latest book.
Well, I've written a book called Jack Holmes and His Friend, which is about a straight man and a gay man who are best friends. And the first half of the book is written from the point of view of the gay man, and the second half is told in the first person by the straight guy. And it was sort of a challenge for me to be able to show both sides of the things. But the part I'm going to read here is where my hero, Jack, who's the gay guy, has come to New York. He's just moved from the Midwest to New York, and he's being sent out by an employment agent for looking for a job. The agent, Shelley, sent him out on two appointments with magazines, one a men's softcore porn monthly and the other a trade publication for the refrigeration industry. Until now, most of the adults Jack had dealt with had been teachers, people paid to praise and nurture promising youngsters. Suddenly he was up against busy, dismissive men who weren't charmed by a candidate's brightness, but were coolly sizing up the possibility of working him hard for very little pay. He was no longer a poodle, but a mule. Neither man hired him. The haphazardness of the adult world shocked him. At school, if you put in some effort, you got good marks, and the ascent was even and never too steep. But here in New York, nothing was systematic. Your chances of being hired were determined by who you knew, what kind of first impression you made, your looks, your accent, your timing. They had just fired someone that morning. even whether or not you reminded the boss of himself or of his younger self. "Hey, kid, you're a go-getter, just like I was. I like that kid," some man had actually said to Howard, who'd landed a job in hospital management. Of course, it helped that Howard's cousin attended the guy's temple in the Five Towns. Anyway, that's it.
So can you give us some idea of where this leads now? What's going to be the next course of action of the story?
He gets a job on a kind of cultural magazine, and that's what he gets a job doing that. It's not very well paying, but it's sort of prestigious, I guess. And that's where he meets his best friend, Will, the straight guy. I mean, I try to trace both of these guys. They're kind of from good, so-called good families, and they're well-educated, and one of them is a kind of East Coast aristocrat and from a horse-riding, fox-hunting family, and the other one is just sort of a indeterminate Midwesterner.
In writing these characters, what do you think was the most important division line between them? Were you writing them as men first? Were you writing them as gay or straight? Or was it a cultural difference between the characters? Class difference, I should say.
Uh-huh, I see what you mean. Well, all the above, in a sense. Like, I definitely tried to squeeze as much juice as I could out of the gay-straight dichotomy. I mean, I kept exploring it again and again. I mean, like, for instance, the gay man has no continuous affairs in the 60s before liberation, because there was the kind of the trap door beside the bed that you were always trying to get rid of, the evidence that you were gay, and only with liberation did there come any degree of self-acceptance and of stability in relationships. I mean, of course they exist, and millions of your listeners will call in and say, "Well, I've been with Howard since 1952, but it was really rare. Whereas straight people, I think, had a lot less easy sex, a lot fewer adventures, but their relationships stuck more. I mean, in other words, if they started going out with each other seriously, it would sort of take and last for at least for a while.
That was author Edmund White. His latest novel is called Jack Holmes and His Friend. Thank you for listening to Arizona Spotlight. This show originates from the AZPM radio studios. The production engineer is Jim Blackwood. The music is by Calexico. I'm Mark McLemore.